making TV special.
Venice. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means.
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
That was The Faint with Agenda Suicide from their 2001 record Dance Macabre, and I had to play that one, one, because its sentiment is timely, and two, I had a good time seeing them again this last Sunday here in Portland. What's up? Welcome, everybody. This is the B-side of episode 99 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you from my bedroom in downtown Portland, Oregon, taking the day off, taking the week off, I suppose, from the Portland Radio Authority show, and I'm chilling at home. It's about 42 degrees outside here in Portland. It's about a quarter after 9 in the morning. I'd be on a bus right now going downtown to do the PRA show, and I still owed you a B-side to episode 99, which has tons of downloads, and I really appreciate you guys out there checking it out. And you can, of course, get in touch with me, MediaMonarchy@yahoo.com, or, of course, IM, or Skype, or FaceSpace, or any of those. And I want to thank Alan out in Omaha, which is where the Faint are from, for getting in touch with me and his kind words, as well as the kind words from my man Jeff down in Alabama, Wall Street Traders. And again, I thank him for his kind words. What we're going to do right now is, of course, what we do here on these B-sides, my little homemade version, the home game of Media Monarchy. And we try and pick up on everything we couldn't cram into the last episode, which, of course, last episode was fortunate enough to have DJ Cliff and Nathan Jimenez, both from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And hopefully, it's looking good. Next Friday, episode 100, a great new special guest in studio on Media Monarchy, episode 100. It's going to be November 21st. It's going to be, of course, the day before the 45th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. So, let's get into it. And we started with a suicide agenda, but now let's move to a talking camera.
This is the Los Angeles Police Department. It is illegal to spray graffiti or dump trash here. The picture has been taken and will be used to prosecute you. Leave now.
A motion detector camera, the voice of a cop. All that's missing is handcuffs. Snapped by the shutter, it's a fine, if not more.
They can certainly go to jail, and we will prosecute, and they will go to jail. And we don't have a doubt we'll be able to identify them once we get them on picture. A lot of the gang members and the taggers, we have a system. We have a tagger task force in North Hollywood that's comprised of officers that focus only on taggers. So we will prosecute them.
Graffiti can be the gateway to more violent crimes.
We've all heard about the tragic story of the woman in Pico Rivera who was killed last summer simply because she was trying to stop some taggers from defacing a wall in her neighborhood. At this past February in North Hollywood, two different tagging crews engaged in a back and forth attacks, putting up graffiti in each other's neighborhoods until one of the kids ended up shot and killed.
Cool, man. Really cool. Because around here is a lot of guns.
And these cameras have been tried and tested. Three installed last year led to an 85% decrease in graffiti at their locations. 10 additional talking cameras are on their way. They are higher resolution, able to identify taggers and license plates up to 250 feet away in total darkness. The first installed anywhere in the U.S. Taggers, you've been warned.
The picture has been taken and will be used to prosecute you. Leave now.
That's the way it starts, you know. It starts something reasonable sounding. Not that I even think that that's all that reasonable. Anyway, let's move to WSWS and see how Gates expands the preemptive war doctrine to include nuclear strikes. So again, this from WSWS.org. In a remarkable speech on nuclear policy delivered on October 28th at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, CEIP, U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates painted a dire portrait of international affairs and argued that Washington should expand the doctrine of preemptive war formulated by the Bush administration to include possible nuclear strikes. It is widely rumored that in the likely event that Democrat Barack Obama wins next week, so okay, this is a little bit old, Obama will keep Gates as defense secretary, and we keep hearing that, and of course there's chatter saying the other way, and we'll get into that. Gates' speech, given in the waning days of the Bush presidency, has the character of a policy declaration of the next U.S. administration. And again, you can link up to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace yourself, and more and more. So, whipping around in the police state USA heading the new technology of repression. This from Consortium News. In its final months, the Bush administration is pressing ahead with a new generation of spy technology designed to strengthen the U.S. military's ability to detect and eliminate suspected insurgents in Iraq and elsewhere based on computer analysis of their movements and activities. The Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA, has been granting projects to software firms to create algorithms, and there's a PDF link for you of one of the contracts, that can be applied to the real-time video feeds from drone aircraft, so the data can be sorted and stored on a wide range of human activities, from digging a ditch to climbing into a car to kissing someone. Another think tank piece, and the PDF download to back it up, Reorganizing U.S. Domestic Intelligence. This is a new report from the RAND Corporation, and this is coming from Home Station. The question of whether the United States needs a new domestic intelligence service that is independent of law enforcement is examined by Greg Treverton of the RAND Corporation in a new report for Congress entitled Reorganizing U.S. Domestic Intelligence. Quote, one of the questions in the fight against terrorism is whether the United States needs a dedicated domestic intelligence agency separate from law enforcement on the model of many comparable democracies. To examine this issue, Congress directed that the Department of Homeland Security perform an independent study on the feasibility of creating a counterterrorism intelligence agency, and the department turned to the RAND Corporation for this analysis, but asked it specifically not to make a recommendation. And more is there. Like I said, you can pull down the MEG full paper, Greg Treverton, Reorganizing U.S. Domestic Intelligence, and the article again comes from homestation.typepad.com, Reorganizing U.S. Domestic Intelligence, and I'm sure we'll see that Obama and Rambo and the coming criminal cabinet will love it. An article from Paul Joseph Watson, two more combat units assigned to the Homeland Brigade. And I think I've lost track now how many we have even at this point. And again, some of these articles are going to be a week plus old at this point, but still important. NORTHCOM has announced that two more U.S. military units will be assigned for domestic homeland security missions, bringing the total number of combat-ready service members operating inside the U.S. to around 4,700. As fears grow about the increasing militarization of law enforcement. The announcement follows the controversy surrounding a September 8th Army Times report, when they, of course, revised it on September 30th, which revealed that the 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Combat Team, Brigade Combat Team, fresh from duties, combat duties in Iraq, would be operating inside America for tasks including, quote, civil unrest and crowd control, end quote, a detail that was later denied by NORTHCOM. Link for you. Despite the concession that forces would be armed with both non-lethal and lethal weapons, as well as having access to tanks. In the next 3 years, the military plans to activate and train an estimated 4,700 service members for specialized domestic operations, according to Air Force General Gene Runart, R-E-N-U-A-R-T, commander of U.S. Northern Command, NORTHCOM, which was created in 2002 for homeland defense missions, reports Colorado Independent, with another link for you. Speaking of domestic troops, this from Reuters. U.S. Border Police arrest Mexican troops. U.S. Border Police arrested 7 Mexican soldiers after they accidentally strayed over the international boundary into Arizona, authorities said. The U.S. Border Patrol said agents encountered the troops in a Humvee a short distance north of the border near Yuma in far west Arizona. The Border Patrol agents on scene established a dialogue with the subjects, who identified themselves as members of the Mexican military. The agents informed them of their presence within the United States. Upon notification, the subjects were peaceably taken into custody. And you can link to the U.S. Border Patrol press link, or rather press release. Finally, under this police state heading, AT&T to try limiting subscribers' data too. So now they're getting into the act, because of course we know Comcast. Thanks, Comcast. They're doing it as well. So, from the LA Times, AT&T Incorporated customers who obsessively play World of Warcraft while downloading dozens of movies, your days of online impunity may be numbered. AT&T has joined the ranks of telecommunications companies that are exploring the idea of limiting the amount of bandwidth that subscribers can use each month. The company began this month to apply such limits, testing the policy first in Reno. Subscribers to AT&T's slowest internet service there will be limited to downloading 20 gigs a month. Those who subscribe to the fastest plan will be able to download as much as 150 gigs a month. Anyone who goes over the limit will pay a buck a gig extra. 20 gigs a month? I don't really keep track, but I'm sure I pull down tons more than that. As I'm sure most of you do as well. So, watch your bill go up. Another mixed bag of news, this under the heading News on the March, DC Madam, Eugenics, Anthrax, Mind Control, and more. First, from the Washington Times, Florida police confirm DC Madam suicide. Police in Florida closed the book on the suicide of the so-called DC Madam, confirming that she hanged herself with a nylon rope rather than face prison time for running an elite prostitution ring. Tarpon Springs police hoped the report would help squelch online speculation that someone killed 52-year-old Deborah Jean Palfrey to keep her from identifying more prominent clients of the Washington-based escort service. Quote, "It's unfortunate that a lot of people seem to be obsessed with the conspiracy theory notion here," end quote, said Preston Burton, the Washington lawyer who represented Palfrey in the trial. "I am aware of no information that would compel a conclusion other than she took her own life. It's a real tragedy that still affects her mother greatly." And the links are there, and you can go back and, of course, check out. And, you know, it was May Day, but I've got a YouTube video up on May Day, DC Madam suicided, ? And it actually has, I believe, tens of thousands of views. So, youtube.com/MediaMonarchy, DC Madam suicided. Moving on to the idea of eugenics. But it's subtle. This from Engadget. Time magazine names 23andMe, the retail DNA test, the invention of the year. Time magazine has released its annual Best Inventions issue, and topping the list is 23andMe retail DNA kit, which offers consumers 23 clinical reports on their genetic risk for everything from psoriasis to prostate cancer. It may not be as well known as last year's iPhone or YouTube the year before that, but the $399 package might signal a significant revolution in preventative medicine, at which point I cut to the last paragraph, or it might bring mankind a disturbing new form of eugenics. Whatever you use it for, the process couldn't be easier. The kit comes with a tube that you spit in and mail it back to the company, which in a mere 4 to 6 weeks will notify you that testing is complete. As you wait for the results to be posted online, you might want to spend some time contemplating the ethical dilemmas posed by this technology. If we move to the Toronto Star, medical atrocities did not end with the Nazi era. The socialization of doctors to evil did not begin in Germany. A Holocaust Education Week gathering heard this week, being last week, and it didn't end there either. So, HolocaustEducationWeek.com. In fact, we hear echoes of it to this day. Quote, "What happened in Germany could have happened elsewhere," said Dr. Joel Abels, A-B-E-L-L-S, a Toronto family doctor and a medical ethics columnist. Abels told the crowd of about 100 at Toronto General Hospital that the slow drift of doctors to taking part in the Holocaust began decades earlier when scientific and political communities began to embrace eugenics, the systemic sterilization of those deemed unfit to procreate. Today, Abel said, a disturbing number of doctors continue to be involved in genocidal campaigns, terrorist organizations, torture, and the interrogation of prisoners of war. A report in the New England Journal of Medicine in September found that the U.S. Army continues to use doctors in its interrogation of suspected terrorists, despite every major medical association condemning the practice. And there is a link to you for the report from the New England Journal of Medicine proving that, of course, doctors involved in torture. Even in Canada and other Western nations, doctors are regularly called on to help decide who gets medical care, such as kidney dialysis or expensive medication, and who doesn't, Abel said, and we're going to get more into that much later in the episode. The danger is that this can lead to questions of who is unfit for treatment and who deserves access to society's scarce resources, the kinds of questions that led to eugenics and euthanasia. And again, there's lots of links, and you can hit up some of the full reports in there. But staying on the EnviroHealth tip, poisoned horses drank too much fluoride.
You can't even call it a stream. It's about 6 inches wide, maybe an inch deep of water, muddy water was coming down the hill. And the horses would go over there and dig a little pool of this dirty, thick, muddy water and would rather drink that water rather than drink the so-called clean city water.
My horse that I call Skipper, right from the get-go when he was born, in his second generation, started out with an attitude. And he'd try to bite me anytime I went by, and even kick me one time, and to the point where at one time I even thought of getting rid of him and getting another horse. This was all while he was on fluoridated water. We noticed it didn't take too long after fluoridation had quit in our water that his attitude changed, and he now is a lover. He's a completely different horse. So I wouldn't sell him or part with him for $1 million. You know, he's a great horse. It had to have been the fluoridation.
Dental fluorosis, and then the attitude problems that Wayne was talking about. Chronic coughing and wheezing, allergic reaction with skin bumps, kidney problems, constant excessive urination, and cancer. Horses, on average, a standing horse, one that is not doing anything, will drink between 10 to 12 gallons a day. A lactating mare can actually double that amount. Ironic thing is the horses that we had get the sickest, the quickest, were the mares that were lactating, the mares that we had for brood mares. So my husband dug the mare back up, took a leg just below the knee, and sent it to Dr. Krug.
To summarize what we found in the Justice horses, one, there is a source of fluoride, namely the artificial fluoridation of the community water, which is the only source of water for the horses and the only source of fluoride, because there is no fluoridated mineral supplements used and there is no fluoride containing fertilizer used on the farm. Two, dental fluorosis. Three, we have the clinical manifestations as documented by Kathy Justice there in numerous pictures. Hoof deformities, thickened bones. Then we have chemical analysis of the bone ash from a number of horses. We have radiographic evidences. Now we are up to 3, 4, 5. We have also microscopic evidences of fluoride damage to the bone tissue, also reported allergy reaction to the artificial fluoridation of the community water. So all with the evidences we have accumulated, there can be no doubt at all, and stated with reasonable scientific certainty, that the Justice horses were and are suffering from chronic fluoride poisoning.
They poison horses, don't they? Jumping to the New York Post, scientists slam FBI anthrax probe. It was an open and shut case, the FBI said. But 3 months after agents pinned the post 9/11 anthrax mailings on Army scientist Bruce Ivins, who committed suicide as the FBI closed in on him, his former colleagues have approached a lawyer to sue the feds for fingering the wrong man, the New York Post has learned. They argue that the FBI abused its power and violated its own policies as they probed an innocent man for 6 months. The move by the Army scientist comes on the heels of a Senate Judiciary Committee demand for an independent review of the case following a hearing with FBI Director Robert Mueller, in which committee members called the Bureau's case an open matter. The Bureau has named a panel of independent scientists to review the evidence against Ivins, a probe that will take 6 to 18 months. Oh, the anthrax news just slowly trickles out as they try and close the book on it. Our next story from alexconstantine.blogspot.com. My man Robert, a coworker, knows about this book, was telling me he has a friend that loves the book, and of course was like, oh, you know, it's a CIA connected book. So he went down the rabbit hole on this one, and I hadn't looked tons into it, but he was telling me more about it. Mind Control, Course in Miracles, a CIA manipulation device. A Course in Miracles, also referred to as ACIM or The Course, originally published in 1975, is a book considered by its students to be their spiritual path. According to Dr. Helen Schuman and the Foundation for Inner Peace, FIP, Dr. Heller Schuchman, I believe that's S-C-H-U-C-M-A-N, Schuchman, and Dr. William Thetford, T-H-E-T-F-O-R-D, Schuchman and Thetford, scribed the book by means of a process coming from a divine source through a form of channeling, which Schuchman referred to as inner dictation. Schuchman described the divine source of her channeling as none other than the person of Jesus Christ. Well, Dr. William Thetford headed the CIA's Mind Control MKUltra Subproject 130 Personality Theory while at Columbia University between 1971 and 78. And there is a long link there for you. And more on William Thetford. I believe he even has his own Wikipedia page. And of course, you can link to acourseinmiracles.com or ACM maybe .org, I believe it is. Dr. Thetford's personal bio, also available on the A Course in Miracles website, makes reference to his involvement in a personality theory research project while professor of medical psychology at Columbia University, but the information does not specifically cite this as a CIA MKUltra subproject. So there are many links in there for you where you can go down the rabbit hole of A Course in Miracles. As we move now to just a tidbit before the 45th anniversary, as I mentioned at the top of the show, this from Washington Whispers, new shocker in the JFK Oswald story. And this is on the U.S. News and World Report website, someone else's blog. So it's usnews.com, Washington Whispers, some 45 years after Jack Ruby was convicted in 1964 of slaying Lee Harvey Oswald, his celebrated irresistible impulse defense is being challenged by Ruby's own words. That's right, the most investigated political assassination in history, the JFK Oswald story, has yet another shocker. Never before revealed interview notes taken by a Ruby biographer and heading to auction strongly suggest that Ruby did not act on impulse when he came face to face with Oswald at the Dallas police station. The notes the biographer used to write stories sold to newspapers to build a legal defense fund quote Ruby saying he quote intended end quote to gun down Oswald. In the story draft, Ruby described seeing Oswald, quote, "I lost my senses, I pulled out my gun and took a couple steps. They could have blown my head off. I only shot him once. I guess I intended, I don't know what." But defense lawyer Melvin Belli edited that and other potentially incriminating Ruby quotes out. Alexander Auctions president Bill Panagopoulos, whose sale takes place November 6th and 7th, tells us undoubtedly much more could be read into these notes. He predicts they'll sell for up to $3,000, and I don't have that update for you, so we'll have to see. It's a little shaky myself, but I don't think we have to go into some other person's scribbled notes to know that something was shady about Ruby sitting in jail telling Warren to please take me to Washington because I can't tell you what I know sitting here in jail. So, a good connection to this, if we go to 911blogger.com, and it's a welcome to the Mary Farrell Foundation. Question, what did the 9/11 Commission learn from the Warren Commission? Answer, don't release 26 accompanying volumes of evidence. More than four decades ago, those 26 volumes, at odds with much of the Warren Report, set off a handful of researchers on parallel journeys to find the truth behind the JFK assassination, trying to succeed where they believed the government had failed them. It is because of those researchers that I'm writing this today. I'm the executive director of the Mary Farrell Foundation and want to take this opportunity to give a brief introduction to the work of the foundation. The MFF is a nonprofit group dedicated to the exploration of the deeper stories behind the national tragedies and crises that shape our lives. Our main topics are the Big Three assassinations, JFK, RFK, and MLK. Our goal is to not only shed light on these tragedies, but place them in a modern context, showing how the events of the past irrevocably affect our present and future. The focal point of the MFF site is the vast document archive, containing currently over 1 million pages of once classified documents, many declassified as recently as the late 1990s. So again, this is the Mary Farrell Foundation. And it's maryferrell.org, MaryFerrell.org. She, of course, I believe, is originally known, to, at least to me, that I think she was the one that put together the index of the 26 volumes of the Warren Report, because they put out all these books, but of course they weren't cross-referenced or indexed. It was a complete mess. I believe she did the work, and it's all up there for you, maryferrell.org. Turning now to our first of what I believe will be a couple obituaries on this B-side of episode 99 of MediaMonarchy.com. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Studs Terkel dies at age 96.
He had a famous face, a rumpled look, and he was one of America's most famous authors. Studs Terkel was an oral historian, an activist, and a broadcaster. According to his son, he died peacefully at his home in Chicago. Terkel was born in New York, but he made a name for himself in Chicago, first as a radio interviewer and later as an author. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1985 for his book, The Good War. In 1997, he received the National Humanities Medal in a ceremony at the White House. His politics were liberal, and he was famous for his red checkered shirts, his white hair, and his cigars. Studs Terkel was 96. Sophia Manos, The Associated Press.
Studs Terkel captured the essence of Chicago in the pages of his best-selling oral histories, chronicling common people and celebrities alike. Along the way, he became an ageless master of listening and speaking, a broadcaster, activist, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author. So Studs Terkel died last Friday at the age of 96. He found his home in Chicago and found it in the gritty aspect of Chicago life, said Russell Lewis, chief historian at the Chicago History Museum. The ne'er-do-wells, the outcasts, the bums, all these people were people he was curious about. They intrigued him. Dan Terkel said his father died at home and described his death as peaceful, no agony. This is what he wanted. Studs Terkel, dead at 96. One last bit, this on the Econo crash. In the last 6 weeks, the Federal Reserve has doubled the amount of total credit in the banking system since 1913. This is from Contrarian Profits. Almost $1 trillion of new credit in 6 weeks. Now, this is written kind of strangely, and it's now coming third-party Contrarian Profits by way of Cryptogon.com. But basically, in 6 lousy weeks, all of the total credit in the banking system created by the Federal Reserve since 1913 was almost instantly, poof, doubled. That's not good. We're going to absolutely shift gears right now and jump to the Anchorage Daily News. And this is a nice follow-up and hopefully really closes the book on this one. Suspended student gets $45,000 settlement in the Bong Hits for Jesus case. The 7-year Bong Hits for Jesus saga appears to be over. In a free speech case that reached the nation's highest court, the Juneau Douglas School District and former student Joseph Frederick have reached a settlement. Frederick was suspended during a 2002 Olympic torch relay for holding up a banner that read, "Bong Hits for Jesus," while standing across from the high school. And of course, I've got the picture nice and big for you. And there's a lot of kids doing it. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the school's position that Frederick celebrated the illegal use of drugs. The district will pay Frederick $45,000. In exchange, Frederick will drop remaining claims not heard by the Supreme Court. Bong hits for Jesus. That was a lighthearted note. Now we're going to get into darker notes with a lot of 9/11 updates and the first batch of new 9/11 updates. New WTC7 videos, Warner warnings, and cover-ups. This first from Michelle Chosudovsky at globalresearch.ca. A second 9/11. An integral part of the U.S. military doctrine. For several years now, senior officials of the Bush administration, including the president and the vice president, have intimated in no certain terms that there will be a, quote, second 9/11. Quotations from presidential speeches and official documents abound. All these authoritative statements point in chorus in the same direction. The enemy will strike again! The presumption of a second 9/11 has become an integral part of the U.S. military doctrine. America is under attack. The U.S. military must respond preemptively. In the immediate wake of the invasion of Iraq in April 2003, remember? Various national security measures were put in place focusing explicitly on the eventuality of a second attack on America. In fact, these procedures were launched simultaneously with the first stage of war plans directed at Iran in May 2003 under Operation Theater Iran Near Term. Tyrant. Fortunately, TV news lies. .org is calling out the bullshit of Snopes.com. Snopes.com lies and continues the 9/11 cover-up. These days, Snopes.com has become the be-all, end-all arbiter of truth. I don't know how this happened. The site's wrong about a great many things. For some reason, people still cite Snopes to me as proof that I'm wrong about one thing or another, as if they were a know-all god that can tell no lie. Well, when it comes to 9/11, Snopes.com is a false and very outdated god. The unreliable and condescending people who run Snopes.com have chosen to belittle and ridicule factual evidence that contradicts the official narrative about the attacks of 9/11. They've chosen to ignore evidence that exposes the many 9/11-related lies told by the Bush administration, stooping so low as to title this particular piece Flights of Fancy, with a link for you. Well, a more respectable website has provided the public with pretty solid evidence contradicting the deception perpetrated by Snopes, the Bush administration, and the criminal establishment media. The flights in question did take place, and the information related to those flights were indeed covered up by the U.S. government. The FBI did contradict its own conclusion when explaining the circumstances involving the flights, and most importantly, the criminal media did absolutely nothing to make the public aware of any of this. If you were paying attention, you would have noticed that this information was originally confirmed by Richard Clark during the 9/11 Commission omission hearings. But for those of you who don't remember, like the people who run Snopes.com, here's some more recent documentation, and there's about eight for you, links. Judicial Watch investigates flight of Saudi nationals after 9/11. Judicial Watch releases new FBI documents. OBL may have chartered Saudi flight out of U.S. after 9/11. Judge orders FBI to correct disclosures concerning government evacuation of Saudi royals and bin Laden family after 9/11. Newly released documents, Watchdog submits documents, and U.S. government documents show 160 Saudis flew from U.S. between September 11th and September 15th, 2001. Returning to 9/11blogger.com, this was one that was new to me. The Phantom USA Today building fire and the evacuation of Arlington's Twin Towers on 9/11. In a recent interview, Assistant Chief James Schwartz of the Arlington County Fire Department, ACFD, revealed an intriguing detail relating to the 9/11 Pentagon attack. Just before the Pentagon was hit, ACFD responded to alarms going off at the USA Today building located a few miles from there. You can see this interview on videos.mcclatchydc.com, and I have the link for you. This interview, and this is, again, Assistant Chief James Schwartz of the Arlington County Fire Department talking. just before the Pentagon was hit, ACFD responded to alarms going off at the USA Today building located a few miles away, yet it is unclear whether there was actually any fire. Other evidence indicates that, as a result of this alarm, when the Pentagon was hit, a significant number of fire and medical units were already on the road nearby and available to quickly respond to the attack. Curiously, the two buildings of the USA Today complex were known as the Twin Towers. And there are more links in there for you to bizjournals.com and more. The Twin Towers of USA Today. Another one from Paul Joseph Watson. Ex-CIA man warned top executives to leave New York City on 9/11. You know, and again, these are now over a week old to me, and I forget how many huge things come out constantly about 9/11, and I just calmly go over it. Oh yeah, we got, you know, ahead of, you know, Warner Brothers saying, oh no, something big's gonna go off that day. And 2 weeks ago we had Bob Baer going, oh yeah, I know the guy that cashed out on September 10th and said shit's going down tomorrow, give me all my money. And we just calmly say, oh yeah, there's all this stuff. And of course there's new videos of World Trade Center 7, there's new buildings, or rather new videos of the old buildings exploding on 9/11. We're going to get to that in a little while. But again, Paul Joseph Watson, ex-CIA man, warned top executives to leave New York City on 9/11. According to a report by Jeffrey R. Hammond of the Foreign Policy Journal, senior executives of a major U.S. corporation were warned by a former CIA operative to leave New York on September 11, 2001, the latest smoking gun to add to a bulging stack of examples concerning specific prior knowledge of the attacks. And again, Jeffrey R. Hammond of Foreign Policy Journal.com broke this story. The article cites an anonymous source who works under a managing director as number two at a European branch of the media giant Warner Brothers. The source's boss was close friends with a senior executive who worked at the head office in L.A. and had also formerly worked for the CIA. During the memorial arrangements for a senior director from a foreign office who had died, the L.A. executive rejected September 11th as a date for the service because, quote, something big is happening that day, end quote, and the top executives from the New York office would all be traveling out of the city. There is more there, and there is more here. From Kurt Nimmo, new World Trade Center video clearly shows demolition. Now, of course, there's nothing for me to play for you here, so you have to check the video out for yourself. A new video has surfaced clearly showing the demolition of Building 7, but in its latest report, of course, NIST attempted to once and for all put to rest the evidence that the building was taken down via demolition by explaining that fires had caused the collapse. Specifically, NIST claimed, quote, thermal expansion had brought about the collapse. As Trish Stevens notes, however, that NIST report, quote, is contrary to all historical, visual, and physical evidence. According to an independent worldwide organization composed of more than 470 engineers and architects, WTC-7 was a 47-story tall skyscraper located more than a football field away from the North Tower and was not hit by any airplane, yet completely collapsed hours after the Twin Towers fell in a similar matter. And of course, there's links in there for you back to 911blogger.com, of course, to read about thermal expansion and more from Trish Stevens on indiebay.org. Now, moving to cnsnews.com, Sensenbrenner said that the real ID would have prevented the 9/11 terrorists from boarding planes. Panelists with the Stop Real ID Coalition are calling for the repeal of the Real ID Act of 2005, which they say violates states' rights and the U.S. Constitution, and it's at StopRealIDCoalition.com, and that it also creates a national identification card that gives the government the ability to monitor citizens and invade their privacy. But Representative F. James Sensenbrenner, Republican of Wisconsin, who helped write the bill with the House Judiciary Committee, said if the law had been in place before 9/11, the 19 terrorists could not have boarded the planes that they crashed into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Quote, we use driver's license as identification documents because there's no national identity card, and I would submit that we would have a greater push for a national ID card in the Congress if we didn't have a real ID. Sensenbrenner was telling all this again to CNSnews.com. Real ID just firms up the state driver's license as a way to prevent a loophole in the system the 19 terrorists were able to exploit to pull off the biggest domestic tragedy in the history of our country. He, of course, also said that the Real ID Act is based on the recommendations of the bipartisan 9/11 Commission. There are always amazing, massive updates happening on historycommons.org and the complete 9/11 timeline, which I wish I had. It's one of those sites that I, you know, there was a short time I used to like to work on Wikipedia and try and upload Simpson photos and work on movie entries before I was doing the MediaMonarchy.com website. But something like HistoryCommons.org is awesome, and I wish I had more time to be involved there and try and help update stuff because it's fascinating. HistoryCommons.org, here are some of the latest updates as of November 2nd. To the complete 9/11 timeline, these focusing on Saudi tracking of 9/11 hijackers. And I believe this is coming from admin Kevin Fenton at HistoryCommons.org. Several entries have been added to the 9/11 timeline in the past fortnight, in particular concerning the attack of the 9/11 hijackers, or rather concerning tracking of the 9/11 hijackers by Saudi authorities. Nawaf al-Hazmi obtained a new passport in Saudi Arabia in 1999. The passport contained an indicator the Saudi authorities used to track his movements. Al-Hazmi obtained a U.S. visa with the passport and entered the U.S. with it. Another hijacker, Ahmed al-Haznawi, possibly obtained a passport with the same indicator before November 2000 and then left Saudi Arabia. It's also been suggested that a third hijacker, Ahmed al-Nami, had a similar indicator in his passport. Now, I believe they're just talking about some sort of mark that goes on their passport to when the dude looks at it, they go, oh. Some of the new entries just concern al-Qaeda in general, covering its plans for manufacturing anthrax, its gassing of a dog, and a discovery of video showing its global reach. What's interesting to note is that one of the Pakistanis involved in these plans was arrested and released by Pakistani authorities, who refused to let the FBI extradite him. There's also more about alleged al-Qaeda plots against the Sydney Olympics and U.S. Embassy in Rome, although this later turned out to be pretty much a figment of the intelligence agency's imagination, and the alleged plotters were acquitted. Miscellaneous entries cover a recent statement by former MI5 chief Stella Remington that the U.S., quote, overreacted to 9/11, as well as two questions asked in 2006 by Senator Patrick Leahy, quote, why did they allow attacks to happen, end quote, and why didn't they get bin Laden? But before being appointed to the 9/11 Commission, its executive director, Philip Zelikow, made some interesting comments about public assumptions. And during the Commission's hearings, Commissioner Jamie Gorelick sparred with General Richard Myers over the Air Force's lack of response on the day of the attacks. Finally, the CIA began tracking Islamist militants in Europe in 1995 and funded a counter-terrorist hit squad in Egypt. And I'll tell you once again that any time we go over all those updates from HistoryCommons.org, that pretty much every active phrase and noun that I just read to you is a link to a new entry of documentation on the massive and crumbling fraud and cover-up of 9/11. Something we missed, and it's now 9 days ago, and of course we forgot to remember the 5th of November, Guy Fawkes Day. And I just have a little post up from Time Magazine. The English, among other talents, are adept at nurturing their grudges. How else does one explain the enduring enmity toward Guy Fawkes, a conspirator in a plot to blow up Parliament in 1605, some 4 centuries after Fawkes was caught, tortured, and executed for his role in a scheme that never came to fruition? Britons still celebrate his demise each November 5th by burning his likeness in effigy and setting fireworks ablaze. Moving down, In recent years, Falk's legacy has broadened. He provided the inspiration for the title character in the Wachowski brothers' V for Vendetta, in which a masked crusader embarks on a terrorist campaign against a totalitarian British dystopia. Falk also proved an effective fundraising rally cry for one-time U.S. presidential candidate Ron Paul, who garnered more than $4 million on the holiday in 2007 from a website commemorating Falk. This year, revelers will gather across Britain, most notably in Lewes, a town once known as a hotbed of anti-Catholicism sentiment that throws one of the British Isles' biggest conflagrations, and in nations ranging from South Africa and Canada to New Zealand and Australia. Guards will also perform the annual search, more pageantry than precaution, of the Houses of Parliament to ensure no would-be fox is lurking. Though the animosity and rituals may merely be symbolic at this point, the celebrations still burn brightly. Now, first, it's interesting to note, too, that, of course, the website, it said, for the Ron Paul Guy Fawkes Day, it wasn't exactly commemorating Fawkes. They used the idea as a rallying cry to raise some money. And it's interesting, too, that Guy Fawkes barely joined in the plot at the last minute, and the plot didn't actually go off, but he was still, you know, caught and tortured and executed. So, sounds a little familiar. Frighteningly familiar. Staying on the 5th of November, and another obituary, Illuminated author Michael Crichton dies of cancer. This from the Associated Press. And of course, I altered the headline. However, his family used the words. I just put it up there. Illuminated author Michael Crichton dies of cancer. Michael Crichton, the million-selling author of such historic and prehistoric science thrillers as Jurassic Park, Timeline, and The Andromeda Strain, has died of cancer. He died last Tuesday in L.A. at the age of 66 after a long battle with the illness. Crichton was a brand-name author known for his stories of disaster and systematic breakdown, such as the rampant microbe of the Andromeda Strain or dinosaurs running amok in Jurassic Park, one of his many books that became major Hollywood movies. Through his books, Michael Crichton served as an inspiration to students of all ages, challenged scientists in many fields, and illuminated the mysteries of the world in a way we could all understand, his family said in a statement. In recent years, he was the rare writer to get on well with President Bush, perhaps because of his skepticism about global warming, which Crichton addressed in the 2004 novel State of Fear. Crichton's views were strongly condemned by environmentalists who alleged that the author was hurting efforts to pass legislation to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide. Which, of course, he was, fortunately. He saw the fraudulent global tax coming soon that, of course, the CFR and the Club of Rome talk about in the first global revolution. The worldwide carbon tax. Bring 'em till they broke it, think I'm joking, you're wrong. Got another one smoking, potent, voting my song. Not another make or break or put your opinion aside and come up on it, listen on it, put it on and let's ride. Wriggle, rhyming, rapper, I'm a signing the times. I beat a leader, drum beater, now you're changing your mind. Beat up, pull your seat up while I'm laying my line. I'm about to break 'em till they broke it, now they broke it, break time. One, two, three. That was Break Time from Rev Run of Run DMC from his solo record from a few years back called Distortion. And we're back on this B-side episode of 99 of MediaMonarchy.com. And now we're going to get into a lot more horrible newer news. And of course, let's glance at Google News this Friday morning, 11:30 a.m. Pacific time on November 14th. We've got wildfires destroying perhaps 100 plus homes in California. Obama met with Hillary Clinton to discuss her possible future role as Secretary of State. And finally, from Reason Online, Ron Paul 2012 question mark. But returning to MediaMonarchy.com under the heading Geopolitics and History Mystery, Russia, Auschwitz, Fanta, Nazis, and Nukes. First, from the Times Online, newsflash, Georgia fired first. We've known that all along, but it's coming out more and more. Two former British military officers are expected to give crucial evidence against Georgia when an international inquiry is convened to establish who started the country's bloody five-day war with Russia in August on 888. Ryan Grist, a former British Army captain, and Stephen Young, a former RAF wing commander, are said to have concluded that before the Russian bombardment began, Georgian rockets and artillery were hitting civilian areas in the breakaway region of South Ossetia every 15 to 20 seconds. Their accounts seem likely to undermine the American-backed claims of President Mikhail Saakashvili of Georgia that his little country was the innocent victim of Russian aggression and acted solely in self-defense. But speaking of Russia, and speaking of more tragedies, Russian nuclear sub accident claimed 20 lives. This from Danger Room, as well as a host of links to the Associated Press and Wikipedia and Ria Novosti and the BBC and more. But originally from Danger Room, Russian nuke sub accident claims 20 lives. An accident on board a Russian nuclear submarine has claimed at least 20 lives, the worst submarine disaster in nearly a decade. According to Russian news reports, the ship in question is the K-152 NERPA, N-E-R-P-A, an Akula-class attack submarine. The accident occurred during sea trials in the Pacific Ocean. Russian news agency Ria Novosti reports the incident was caused by the unsanctioned activation of the boat's fire-extinguishing system. The sub returned to Bolshoi Kamen, a port in Russia's Far East, the BBC adds. Over 200 individuals were on board, including civilian shipbuilding contractors. Again, Ria Novosti reports that the incident happened in the boat's forward compartment. The nuclear reactor was not affected, and radiation levels were described as normal. A torpedo accident on the Russian submarine Kursk in 2000 claimed the lives of 118 soldiers. The accident and the botched response were a public relations disaster for then-Russian President Vladimir Putin in his first year in office. And you can click a link for Putin's video appearance on Larry King Live, and you can see that when asked what happened to the Kursk, Putin smirks, she sank. The NERPA incident comes as Russia reasserts its military power and prepares to overhaul its nuclear forces. Russia is currently sending a naval squadron to Venezuela to take part in a military exercise, which we've covered for you here. The Russian media are responding swiftly to this one. And there's also a link to a Russian Wikipedia page for NERPA and a list of the latest headlines in Russian. If we move to Iran and Press TV, they note that Al-Qaeda, OBL, Boogie Boogie, Emmanuel Goldstein are, quote, plotting new attacks on the U.S. America's nemesis, Osama bin Laden, is reportedly planning a new terror attack against the U.S. that would outdo by far the 9/11 attacks. A source close to the Al-Qaeda leadership in Yemen has warned in a report that a new attack against the U.S. will aim to, quote, change the world both politically and economically. The report, published by an Arabic-language newspaper in London, Al-Quds Al-Arabi, claimed that bin Laden was closely supervising preparations for the attack, which will be far greater than those of 9/11. And we will return to those threats and the threataganda and more 9/11 updates just a little bit later. But now to Berlin and the AFP, plans for Auschwitz found in Berlin apartment. Original plans for the construction of the Nazi extermination camp of Auschwitz, including a gas chamber and crematorium, have been found in a Berlin apartment, a newspaper reported last Saturday. The Daily Bild, B-I-L-D, published copies of some of the 28 plans, which the head of Germany's Federal Archives, Hans-Dieter Kriekamp, called, quote, authentic proof of the systematically planned genocide of the Jews of Europe. Bild gave no indication of where, when, or by whom the plans were found. And I believe if we hit some of the links within that story, we'll see that I believe it's maybe even Haaretz themselves. Yes, from Haaretz. Auschwitz expert says blueprints found in Berlin, not of death camp. So, you can take it from the Jewish press right there, saying that, yeah, these aren't really it. However, staying on topic, there's a long article from the one and only Edwin Black, the man behind the books such as The Plan, which we just covered a few weeks ago, and of course, IBM and the Holocaust, and War Against the Weak, and many, many other books. And again, it's always important to note that his books are published by major publishers, so the claims are triple-checked. You don't see Coca-Cola suing Edwin Black. You don't see IBM suing Edwin Black, because he's documented it all out. Right here, we're going to make a note that, of course, Fanta was developed for the Nazis.
And companies like Coca-Cola, because they couldn't keep the Coca-Cola going, so what they did was they invented Fanta Orange for the Germans. And that's how Coke was able to keep their profits coming in to Coca-Cola. So when you drink Fanta Orange, that's the Nazi drink that was created so that Coke could continue making money while millions of people died.
That's a quick clip of Michael Moore from the fantastic documentary The Corporation, which if you haven't seen it, you must. Of course, noting that Fanta is the drink of the Nazis. I often have fun pointing that out to coworkers at the store. Anyway, the article is long and I'm not going to go all the way into it. However, it's fascinating and there are interesting photos and links for you. But ultimately, we know that in 1942, at the height of World War II, a Coca-Cola license bottler became a tenant in the building of Raphael Biggio, whom this article focuses on. So when that Coca-Cola licensed bottler became the family's tenant, bottling the world-famous cola. Later, the fruity drink called Fanta, that Coca-Cola originally developed for the Nazi military, was added. Now, interestingly enough, again, we can jump to Snopes.com, and they say it's false that Fanta was... See, and this is how they do it. If you go to Snopes.com/CokeLore/Fanta.asp, you'll see, claim, Fanta was invented by the Nazis. That's false. And that's the trick. We didn't say that Fanta was invented by the Nazis. We're saying that Coca-Cola switched ingredients that severed the obvious link to doing business with inside the Reich long after it became illegal. It was a little smoke and mirrors, so the Nazis didn't invent Fanta. Coke helped them make it. And, of course, collected the profits, profiteering during the war. Like our president's grandfather did. So, just another example of the Snopes.com bullshit. A little more history mystery. The mystery of the lost U.S. nuclear sub. This was amazing new information to me, and one that warrants probably a lot more investigation, just given some of the names and occurrences that happened in this story. Coming from the BBC, the mystery of the lost U.S. nuclear sub. The United States abandoned a nuclear weapon beneath the ice in northern Greenland following a crash in 1968. This found by a BBC investigation. Its unique vantage point, perched at the top of the world, has meant that the Thule Air Base, that's T-H-U-L-E, of course the same name as the Thule Society or Thule Society, it's meant that the Thule Air Base has been of immense strategic importance to the U.S. since it was built in the early 1950s, allowing a radar to scan the skies for missiles coming over the North Pole. The Pentagon believed the Soviet Union would take out the base as a prelude to a nuclear strike against the U.S. and so in 1960 began flying quote-unquote chrome dome missions. Nuclear-armed B-52 bombers continuously circled over Thule and could head straight to Moscow if they witnessed its destruction. Its destruction meaning the Thule Air Force Base. Greenland is a self-governing province of Denmark, but the carrying of nuclear weapons over Danish territory was kept secret. But on January 21st, 1968, one of those missions went wrong.
So I sort of glance over the fjord there. I see the explosion. I don't hear anything at first. I see a real powerful explosion.
I was in the non-commissioned officers club with a bunch of friends. Tradition, we usually met there on a Sunday afternoon having drinks, when all of a sudden the building shook, and then the news came through that a plane had crashed on the ocean ice.
The problem was what to do with all the debris. You see, you scraped all the debris together, and that was put into a sort of smaller containers on truck. Called back to the base. I was told it was not dangerous. And as I say, no one sort of dropped dead. We didn't know very much about it. We were young, dashing men. It was a job, and it was nice for a group of Danes to prove to the great American Air Force that we could do something that they couldn't.
I was never given any protective equipment. I just went out whatever you normally wore at work and walked around the crash site right next to the barrier. They had it roped in and came back to the base. There was never any test done. So you had this special team with the airmen in full protective equipment climbing on top of these 50,000 gallon drums and containers. And I was down there daily, basically, and I had no protective equipment.
All of the crew compartment is from roughly here forward. The fire was on the lower deck at the aft end of the crew compartment, so it would have been right about here.
We were probably a little over six hours in the mission when things started to deteriorate.
We were in our holding pattern type of configuration, low power, high altitude, saving fuel. And a fire started in the cockpit that got out of control and just wasn't controllable.
I would say within 5 minutes we knew the fire was out of control. By that time I had declared emergency and told them that we need immediate descent to Thule, Greenland. We knew that we had very little time to get to Thule before we'd be in real trouble, and if we had to bail out early we would really be in trouble.
First and only time in my life I've ever said Mayday, but I gave a Mayday call.
Eventually the lights disappeared and I heard somebody say, "Are we over Thule yet?" And I leaned up and looked out the window shield. I couldn't see the lights and I says, "Okay, we're over Thule. Crew, bail out." And I reached down and turned on the abandon light. And at that point I heard bang, 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 bang. And that was four of the crew members using their ejection seat.
When the plane caught on fire, the crew tried to land at Thule Air Base behind me, but they didn't make it. The plane crashed out there onto the bay, which at wintertime is thick with ice. The plane crashed and broke into 1,000 pieces. Now, the conventional explosives around the nuclear weapons went off, caught on fire, and what seems to have happened is that one of the nuclear bombs burnt through the ice and sank down into the bay.
More history, mystery, horror. Horror of U.S. depleted uranium in Iraq threatens the world. This comes from the Tehran Times. American and British use of DU, depleted uranium, is a crime against humanity which may, in the eyes of historians, rank with the worst atrocities of all time. War vets who've returned from Iraq are sitting on DU death row. All this a net result of the White House's reaction to 9/11. The writer says, "I'm horrified. The people out there, the Iraqis, the media, and the troops, risk the most appalling ill health. and the radiation from depleted uranium can travel literally anywhere. It's going to destroy the lives of thousands of children all over the world. We all know how far radiation can travel. Radiation from Chernobyl reached Wales, and in Britain you sometimes get red dust from the Sahara on your car. Britain and America not only used DU in this year's Iraq War, they dramatically increased its use, from a minimum of 320 tons in the previous war, in 91, to a minimum of 1,500 tons in this one. And this time, the use of DU wasn't limited to anti-tank weapons, as it had largely been in Gulf War I, but was extended to the guided missiles, large bunker busters, and 2,000-pound megabombs used in Iraq's cities. Fortunately, now a little bit of a bright note, and I instantly thought, when you think of pranks and hoaxes, I remember it would be what Jello Biafra would call monkey wrenching the New World Order. This is an amazing one, and I haven't been able to ask my brother, who lives in Manhattan, if he was able to get a copy of one of these things. Pranksters distributed fake New York Times all over New York declaring Iraq war over.
Citizens of the Big Apple got a big shock when they picked up a special edition of the newspaper on the streets. But the year's story turned to be a hoax organized by a liberal group which calls itself Yes Man. Using an authentic New York Times template, they created a 14-page edition, which they also put online. But eagle-eyed readers would have noticed the date of the publication was the 4th of July, 2009. Time will tell, though, if its predictions proved true, but it also outlined how George Bush is facing high treason charges and that Condoleezza Rice apologized for false information about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
Some commuters got their hands on what looks like a special edition of the New York Times with this headline, Iraq War Ends. As you might have guessed, though, it's a fake.
Listen, David, this was handed to me this morning on the streets of Manhattan. And right away, with the headline, Iraq War Ends, you look closer. At the top, all the news we hope to print. The hoax apparently in the works for 6 months. 1.2 million of these fake papers printed and passed out by thousands of volunteers. We mentioned the headline there, but also there were fake stories about the UN passing an across-the-board weapons ban and President Bush being indicted on charges of high treason. It even includes fake editorials. One more, you know, show that this might be a hoax. The paper is actually dated July 4th, 2009. And I'm looking at this thinking, why would they do this? Well, the real New York Times says this is unauthorized, looking into who published it.
This from commondreams.org. The U.S. Defense Department yesterday declared the end of the Iraq War and the immediate withdrawal of all troops, prompting an admission from Condoleezza Rice that the Bush administration knew all along that Saddam Hussein had no WMD, according to the New York Times. On second thought, that introductory paragraph needs a little clarification. The New York Times proper didn't report the end of the Iraq War, but a spoof 14-page special edition of the newspaper circulated free on the streets of Manhattan did carry those items. It was printed in a form that was so high quality and technically accurate that many New Yorkers were nonplussed, backed up by an entire New York Times website that equally faithfully mimicked the original, and it's nytimes-se.com. Dated July 4th, 2009, and boasting the front page motto, all the news we hope to print, in a twist on the Daily's famous phrase, all the news that's fit to print, the fake paper looks forward to the day the war ends and envisages a chain of events that would be manna from heaven for American liberals. And lots of other people as well. Fake left-right paradigm. In one story, ExxonMobil is taken into public ownership. In another, evangelical churches, the backbone of the Bush-supporting Christian right, open the doors of their megachurches to Iraqi refugees. You can download the full 9.7-megabyte PDF of the amazing 14-page New York Times special edition, Iraq War Ends.
Early this morning, commuters nationwide were delighted to find out that while they were sleeping, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan had come to an end. According to the newspaper's publishers, 1.2 million papers were printed at six different presses. They were driven to a number of prearranged pickup locations. where thousands of volunteers stood ready to pass them out on the street. Articles in the paper announced the establishment of national health care, the abolition of corporate lobbying, a maximum wage for CEOs, and of course, the end of the war. The paper includes international, national, New York, and business sections, as well as editorials, advertisements, and even a page of corrections.
I don't know, it's like a dream, you know, you talk about it, everybody's talking about it, it's like this war needs to end, and here the war is over. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe it.
And I knew change was coming to America, I just didn't expect it so fast. It's incredible.
This could really expand our idea of what's possible.
This is a deep, positive, potential thing happening here, and so I'll take the prank for that, and I think the Times should too.
Well, I don't understand what statement they're trying to make. We've been all over the Bush administration since day one. We set the standard for coverage of the Iraq War.
Like Judith Miller?
You know, we have to exercise some muscles we either don't have or that have atrophied or something. A civic muscle, a thrifty muscle, a generous muscle.
I can't believe it. The war is over. Wow, unbelievable. My God, I don't know what to say. I'm trembling.
Well, what if? What if?
So that you are looking at. This is Ben Kitzer reporting from New York City.
Monkey wrenching the new world order. Let's now move to spies, lies, and FBIs, KBR, SSX, Spitzer, Bird, Hatfill, and more. We're going to kick it off with an article from the New York Post. This one, of course, always cynical and snarky from the New York Post. The Big Apple's eyeing you. They're watching you. The NYPD's plan to have 5,000 cameras trained on every sidewalk crack south of Canal Street has begun in a space-age hub that will be operating by the end of the month. The Ring of Steel Command Center, which will keep 24-hour watch on high-profile targets like the World Trade Center, the Stock Exchange, and the Brooklyn Bridge, is on the 28th floor of a nondescript building at 55 Broadway. Modeled after a highly touted network in London, the $89 million Lower Manhattan Security Initiative will fight crime and terrorism by blanketing the 1.7 square miles with 500 cameras. The feds will pick up $70 million of the cost. Police intend to be using 2,000 cameras by 2009 and 3,000 cameras by 2011. They also, of course, hope to tap into images from an additional 2,000 private cameras, which means corporate cameras. It'll all be tied in. GIG. Global Information Grid. If we hit the UK for a moment, ID card on track, says UK government, and this is from ZDNet, so this just in the ongoing ID card issue. They say, the Home Office, that is, that identity card delivery is going to be on time and on budget from the Home Secretary. However, the important thing, so it's the story within the story here, is that Bruce Schneier says that we shouldn't get all hot and bothered over ID cards, because they're just temporary technology before unseen biometrics take over everything. And that's an interesting point that I hadn't thought about. And again, masters of misdirection, they get us to pay attention to one thing and miss the other thing. The magician twirls his baton to distract you from what the other hand is doing. And what the other hand is doing is usually incorrect. This from Reuters. FBI finds most terrorism threat reports baseless. The FBI tracked about 108,000 potential terrorism threats or suspicious incidents from mid-2004 to November 2007, but most were found groundless, a Justice Department review found last Friday, with a link to the FBI press release for you there. The department's Office of Inspector General gave the figure in an audit of the FBI's terrorism case tracking system called Guardian, launched in 2002 after 9/11. The FBI determined that the overwhelming majority of the threat information documented in Guardian has no nexus to terrorism. However, as a result of information reported in Guardian, the FBI initiated over 600 criminal and terrorism-related investigations from October 06 to December 07. The report did not discuss the results of the investigations. And you can download the MEG.3 PDF, the Federal Bureau of Investigations Terrorist Threat and Suspicious Incident Tracking System, the whole audit report from Glenn Fine and the Office of the Inspector General. Moving to the UPI, KBR, to provide power during emergencies. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, USACE, has contracted Kellogg Brown & Root, KBR, to provide power during emergency or disaster situations. U.S. company KBR was awarded a $75 million deal from the Army Corps of Engineers for disaster relief services. Under the contract, KBR will supply emergency power for the western region of the United States in case of a natural or man-made disaster. KBR officials say during an emergency situation they will provide labor, transportation, and equipment, among other services, to support power requirements for designated critical public facilities. This award allows KBR the opportunity to expand our capabilities portfolio in the government and infrastructure business to include emergency response, an area of growth due to recent national disasters, Bruce Stansky, KBR Government and Infrastructure President, said in a statement. We look forward to continuing our relationship with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in this new area and are committed to providing the premier services the Army Corps has come to expect of KBR. And what can we expect from past history of KBR? Let's hit the flashback link, my friends, and jump back to May 11th, 2006. DynCorp Halliburton sex slave scandal won't go away. And you can read all about how the Halliburton subsidiary, KBR, have both been linked to trafficking-related concerns. That would be human trafficking. And run the search right there. U.S. stalls on human trafficking from the Chicago Tribune. And it calls out DynCorp and Halliburton. And again, I'll always remind you to Google McKinney grills Rumsfeld. And you can see Cynthia McKinney ask Rumsfeld if it's government policy to continually give contracts to companies that have been implicated and indicted in sex slavery and human trafficking. If we move to Wikinews right now, U.S. Secret Service officer arrested in prostitution sting. A United States Secret Service officer has been arrested in Washington, D.C. after allegedly soliciting a prostitute for sex. The prostitute turned out to be an undercover D.C. police officer. The Secret Service officer was using his official Secret Service patrol car, which was marked and was also in full uniform at the time of the arrest. The unnamed Secret Service officer, a sergeant, was arrested after allegedly agreeing to pay the undercover officer $20 to get oral sex. After agreeing on the price, the undercover officer told the Secret Service officer to drive around the corner where the sex act would take place. When he stopped his car, he was arrested by police officers. This original story comes from the Washington Post, where I believe they threw it in the middle of their metro section in the B area. So yeah, Secret Service officer in sex sting. And so we'll see if we can find out that guy's name. Speaking of sex stings, and one that we know is bullshit, again, from the Washington Post, Spitzer won't face charges for scandal. Former New York Governor Elliot L. Spitzer will not face criminal charges for his role in a prostitution scandal that drove him from office this year. Investigators for the FBI and the IRS uncovered no evidence that Spitzer had misused public or campaign money to pay women employed by the Emperor's Club VIP, a high-priced New York prostitution ring. Now, of course, as we went over a couple of months ago on MediaMonarchy.com, there was an article and a video, I believe, from Brass Check TV called The Assassination of Elliot Spitzer, and they were, of course, referring to the political assassination of Elliot Spitzer, and I pointed out if it was either an assassination or a suicide, his suicide note was published on Valentine's Day in 2008 in the Washington Post, and the article, if you'll recall, was called Predatory Lenders, Partner in Crime. how the Bush administration stopped the states from stepping in to help consumers, basically calling out ahead of time just some of the crisis that we see going on right now. Hitting my home state of West Virginia, this from thinkprogress.org, Robert Byrd steps down as chair of Appropriations Committee. Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat of West Virginia, announced on November 7th that he will voluntarily step down as chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee on January 6th. Byrd, who is the longest-serving senator in American history, said in a statement that he made the decision, quote, only after much personal soul-searching and after being sure of the substantial Democratic pickup of seats in the Senate. I'm now confident that stepping aside as chairman will not adversely impact my home state of West Virginia. Democrats had been hoping that Byrd would step aside voluntarily due to concerns that he was not up to the immense challenges that he would face in that job. Byrd will be replaced by Senator Daniel Inouye, Democrat of Hawaii. You might know him from the infamous Rex 84 clip where Congressman Jack Brooks is asking about continuity of government. He's the one banging the gavel saying, I must most respectfully ask that you not talk about continuity of government. It's classified. So there he is, taking over from Senator Robert Byrd as the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee on January 6th. A little more on some anthrax. This from the Associated Press. Newspapers seek government documents in anthrax query. Two newspapers asked a federal judge Wednesday to make public several documents relating to a former Army scientist who was named as a person of interest in the 2001 anthrax attacks and later exonerated. It's the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, and they want the government's search warrants and supporting documents involving Stephen Hatfill, who was eventually cleared in the anthrax attacks and was awarded $5.8 million in a lawsuit accusing the DOJ of violating his privacy. Normally, search warrants would be sealed for a person who has not been charged or indicted, but the public has a right to know why investigators wanted to search Hatfill's home and on what basis the courts agreed to allow those searches, the newspapers both argued in U.S. District Court. The quote, the public has a right to know why he was targeted, end quote, said Jeanette Melendez Bede, a lawyer for, again, the New York Times and the L.A. Times. Finally, under the post-heading of Spies, Lies, and FBIs, new rule kicks Patriot Act foes right in the teeth. The Bush administration has been planning since last spring to issue a final burst of federal regulations just before leaving office. It was recently announced that over 90 new regulations would be finalized before November 22nd. 60 days prior to the end of Bush's term, making them difficult, though not impossible, for President Obama to reverse. Although many of the regulations have to do with energy and the environment, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow noted on Tuesday that there's also, quote, one that'll kick opponents of the Patriot Act right in the teeth.
So what do we have to look forward to from the Bush last days in the White House? You want one that'll kick opponents of the Patriot Act right in the teeth? How about law enforcement officials spying on us, all of us, everyone? Even if non-criminals not engaging in criminal activities are among us. Aunt Edna, you too. In July, the Justice Department proposed a regulation that would allow state and local law enforcement agencies to collect intelligence on individuals and organizations, even if the information is unrelated to any criminal matter. Think about that for a minute. Sure, go ahead, collect the intelligence. Doesn't have to have anything to do with a criminal investigation. President Bush, according to the Washington Independent, is keen on the idea. Even if they weren't already watching you, they soon could be, really easily.
Moving now to a lot of important news posted up by Greg Nixon at dailydoseofterror.blogspot.com. I've got two full headings of just some of the amazing drills and threataganda going on. First, we've got Daily Dose of Terror drills, DARPA, Sims, and Do. DARPA wants a simulation. They want a sim to resurrect battlefield trauma. Originally, this comes from Danger Room, of course. Far-off commanders can already watch battles unfold thanks to spy drones streaming video overhead. They can read after-action reports to learn how troops on the ground experience the fight. But those officers don't have detailed, digitally animated simulations merging all that info and showing how similar fights might go in the future. which is a simulation DARPA, the Pentagon's Blue Sky Research Arm, would like to fix. The agency's holding a mid-December meeting in Virginia to launch its, quote, Resurrect, Restoring Survivability by Reconstructing Trauma, Resurrect. It aims to, quote, create high-fidelity computer sims of war zone events for tactical, operational, and strategic review. If we now move to The Economist, fighting with photons. The most famous weapon of sci-fi is rapidly becoming fact. Like so much else in science fiction, the ray gun was invented, of course, by H.G. Wells. Our good friend and the author of New World Order and The Open Conspiracy. In the tentacles of Wells' Martians, it was a weapon as unanswerable by Earthlings as the Maxim gun is in the hands of British troops was unanswerable by Africans. Sci-fi, though, it has remained. Neither handheld pistols nor giant orbiting anti-missile versions of the weapon have worked, but that's about to change. The first serious battlefield ray guns now being deployed, and the next generation now in the lab is coming soon. The deployed ray gun, or directed energy weapon, in the tedious jargon that military men seem compelled to use to describe technology, is known as Zeus. With links for you, of course, about directed energy weapons and Zeus. It's not designed to kill. Rather, its purpose is to allow you to remain at a safe distance when you detonate unexploded ordnance, such as the homemade roadside bombs that plague foreign troops in Iraq. The Missile Defense Agency has released a fact sheet about its airborne laser, and of course Raytheon has a video and a press release all about it. So you got PDFs and videos for you there, but also hit the history of directed energy weapons from 911researchers.com with a link for you. Moving to MarketWatch, something interesting, and again, you'll start to see these things being used in the homeland. Not just in Iraq. Eads North America's Tentainer Mobile Shelter. And there are photos. You can check this out. It's a compact and highly deployable mobile shelter for military medical support missions, emergency response, and disaster relief unveiled by a company called Eads North America, EADS. And it was at an Association of Military Surgeons convention in San Antonio. The new unit, called Tentainers, a hybrid shelter that combines rigid-walled, lightweight, lower container with a yabba-dee-ba. But basically, it's going to be a quick little station that they can set up to treat trauma and first aid and mobile command posts. So coming soon to a drill near you. Speaking of drills, Kuwaiti Navy and NATO conclude military drills in the Gulf. This from RTTnews.com. Kuwaiti Navy and ships from the Standing NATO Maritime Group 2 concluded strategic military exercises last Sunday, the first of their kind in the Gulf region. The joint exercises were part of the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative and a security agreement with the NATO on info exchange. The six-day drills included fast inshore attack training, anti-piracy demonstration, an air defense exercise, and a demonstration of firepower. From another posting on dailydoseofterror.blogspot.com, test drill at Miami International Airport aims to slow pandemics. This from the Miami Herald. About 400 people participated in the nation's first pandemic flu exercise at Miami International Airport. What if a deadly global pandemic were sweeping across the world and the U.S. needed to try to delay its effects on our shores? For the first time, at Miami International Airport on Wednesday, November 5th, about a dozen federal, state, and local agencies participated in a simulation exercise to review the steps needed to screen international passengers arriving in the face of a severe influenza pandemic. Quote, it's an opportunity to test the plan, see how it works and what needs to be improved so that when we need to use it for real, we are ready, said Christine Pearson, spokeswoman for the CDC in Atlanta. About 400 people participated in the test drill, including about 200 voluntary actors. CDC, DHS, DOT led the effort. A pandemic is inevitable, but we can't say it's imminent. If we move to spacewar.com, Navy intercepts ballistic missile target in fleet exercise. Vice Admiral Samuel J. Locklear, commander of the U.S. 3rd Fleet, has announced the successful Navy attempt of ballistic missile targets over the Pacific Ocean during fleet exercise Pacific Blitz. And there are links in there for you to read about Pacific Blitz and, of course, maritime BMD concept of operations, ballistic missile defense. The AFP has more on NATO, voicing their serious worries about Russian missile plans. Again, from the French agency press, NATO has serious worries about the compatibility of Russian plans to deploy missiles in a Western Russian enclave with armed control arrangements. We have seen the press reports on the statement of President Medvedev regarding deployment of Iskander missiles to the Kaliningrad region. If confirmed, it would raise serious worries concerning the conformity with existing arms control arrangements, which are of importance for European security. So it's okay if one side has missiles and missile defense, but the other can't do the same thing. Venezuela and Russia discuss nuclear energy and flights. This is from the Associated Press. We already mentioned their war game drills they're running together. Top Venezuelan and Russian officials met last Thursday to discuss bilateral agreements on everything from nuclear energy to direct flights connecting Caracas to Moscow. Russian Deputy Prime Minister Igor Sechin, S-E-C-H-I-N, headed a delegation of business leaders visiting Venezuela to discuss development plans prior to Russian President Medvedev's visit later this month. In a moment when the banks of the developing world are going bankrupt and disappearing, our two countries are negotiating the creation of a binational bank that will allow the financing of development, Venezuelan Vice President Ramon Carrizales said. Moving to China, SpaceDaily.com. China's space industry takes off. China put another two satellites in orbit last Wednesday, just weeks after its third successful manned space mission and the first spacewalk by Chinese astronauts in September. And finally, from Scientific American, more on anthrax. Postal anthrax aftermath: has biodefense spending made us safer? As the FBI was about to move in, of course, Ivins committed suicide, thereby possibly closing the chapter on the first and by far, so far rather, only fatal bio attack in U.S. history. The FBI alleged that Ivins, who worked at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRID, in Fort Detrick, Maryland, mailed anthrax-laden letters in September and October 2001 that killed five people. The incident sparked a massive infusion of research funds to counter civilian bioterrorism. $41 billion spread over seven federal departments and agencies, yet some observers argue that those funds have done little to guard against another bioterror incident, especially if the FBI is right about Ivins. Now we're going to get a little bit later on a level 4 new biolab they're trying to set up. Oh, let's build it at the Plum Island spot. So there's a Wired video coming up here in just a little bit about Plum Island. But again, it always, on these labs and things, always just make me pose the thought and the question. It always comes from the lab, whether it's released accidentally or during a drill, or accidentally during a drill, whether it's foot and mouth and port and down and perbrite, or God knows what. They say they need to work on these things to protect us, but they're the only fucking people that know how to make it in the first place.
Before we continue with this exciting story, here is a word from your announcer.
It is the story of a cancer at the heart of America and of its continuing cover-up at the highest level. One man is attempting to uncover the full story.